Welcome to the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of SCAF, the Strength and Conditioning Association of Professional Hockey. My name is David Rosales, and today I'm joined by Mike Potenza for episode 4 of our SCAF alumni series, along with Mr. Peter Friesen. A lot of you will probably know Pete. He was the head athletic trainer and strength and conditioning coach for the then Hartford Whalers and / Carolina Hurricanes from 1997 all the way until 2017. Since then, he's been an adjunct professor at multiple universities in the Raleigh, North Carolina area, and Pete is one of we joked beforehand. Mike warned me. He says, whatever question you ask to Pete, make sure it's a good one because he'll just get going, and that's exactly what happened in this episode. In fact, I even left clipped in a little portion of the episode that wasn't meant to be part of the recording, but we had it recorded, so I plopped at the beginning. Pete reflects on his time, his long time in the NHL, but we also look ahead at things that he's thinking about a lot right now and really digging into questioning some of the assumptions of things that in strength conditioning we're not getting right now. And this is an episode that really challenged my thinking and made me rethink a few concepts. And I hope that you get something similar out of it. As always, you can find links to everything in the show notes at the official website of SCAF, prohockeystrength.com. Without further ado, here is Mike Potenza and Peter Friesen.
You ever asked him how he scored goals? Because, you know, you want to, does he need soft hands? Does he need the outside speed or something like that? And he says, no, Pete, you ask the coach. And most of the time they tell you all that guy did to make a living to score goals in the NHL was park his ass in front of the net and the puck would bounce off his body into the net. And so, you know, the thing is that gave me good input, you know, on stabilization exercises and what he need to do in front of the net sort of thing. But I wouldn't have done that, got that kind of information if I wouldn't have talked to the coach and him about the position of that he played and what his abilities were. So
that parking spot is still available and it makes a lot of people money in this league. Yeah,
exactly.
But it's funny how many times you get to tell a young kid like, hey, go there and just be strong and tough and you're going to have a job for a long time.
Yeah. You know? But it takes a certain degree of grit to be able to do that. And I think that's also something that you can develop not only on the ice, but also in the training room, to be honest with you. Or when I say the training room, I always mean the strength room or, you know, condition, wherever that might be.
Good. Awesome. Let's get started.
We're already going. Welcome back to the Hockey Strength Podcast. Today's guest, we have Mike back, of course, who's been my co-host for these alumni episodes, and Mr. Pete Friesen. Pete, welcome to the show. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And actually, in my hockey circles, my friends and athletes always call me Pistol. So it might be, I don't know, Pete's pretty easy to remember, but Pistol might even be easier.
Yeah, we've had a good nickname train going. We had Goldie on, and I see everyone calls Mike Potsy, which I don't know if that'll work for me, but I totally see that.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's something in ice hockey. Even my wife has a nickname. Her name's Shelly, but everybody calls her Shell Dog in the hockey circle. So it's something with hockey that gets nicknamed sort of thing.
Absolutely. Someone should write a book about that. For yeah. Sure. About the language of hockey. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, it's true. It's a nomenclature all to its own.
Absolutely. Pete, why don't you start by telling us your background in hockey? Or some of our audience might not know you. You started with the Carolina Hurricanes back in 1997. So why don't you tell us how that job came about and what things were like back then?
Sure. To be honest with you, I do a lot of virtual teaching right now, and they told me not to expound on the years that you've been working and stuff like that, but to give dates. So I'm going to give you dates. And so if you want to figure it out how long I've been around, you can just do the addition yourself or the subtraction. But I got my first job in ice hockey in 1980. And I was really, excited. I was working with a junior team in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, and the Prince Albert Raiders, which went on to, you know, great deal of success, and we won back-to-back national championships. And so, but like we started before the show started, actually, they didn't really care. When I got that job with the Prince Albert Raiders, they didn't really care if I knew how to tape an ankle or to lift a dumbbell or whatever. They wanted somebody that would control the equipment, you know, like so the kids wouldn't steal it and also drive the bus. So that's where my beginning started with the Prince Albert Raiders. But with that, I was attached to or associated with a winning program and a winning coach. Terry Simpson really was the guy that gave me my first job with the Prince Albert Raiders. But he went on to a lot of success in Canadian junior hockey. And with that, he brought me along, and I was very involved with the junior national program. I think 5 world championships, and I was at the tournament 7 times. And also from that, then I went on to senior hockey. But with that said, I was a phys ed teacher. And so again, I came back, I played college 3 football. Like, no, we didn't have a strength coach. I don't even think we had a weight room when I went to school in the 70s. Remember, if you want to do the math, you have to do it yourself to tell you how many years ago I went to university. But I got involved. Like, I didn't bus drive, and I could do that, and I could take care of the stick so kids wouldn't steal them on me. But then I started seeing more to it. These were hardworking athletes on the ice, but I always had the mandate that I could prevent injuries and maybe enhance performance even back then. And you got to remember, there wasn't much going on in strength and conditioning. And it's still limited in Canada versus the United States. But so I took a strong role in strength and conditioning, not just taping ankles and stuff like that. But I went on after that, got involved in the national program. But I went on to University of Saskatchewan, where I was the head trainer. But also, they didn't have a strength coach in it at the time. We had barely a weight room at the University of Saskatchewan. So I kind of picked up that hat, too. I stopped driving the bus and just been the strength coach and the trainer at the University of Saskatchewan. And then my next leap was over to University of Alberta, where I was again the head trainer. And I took on the responsibilities as a head strength coach because basically they didn't have anybody. So there was a need there. And again, not driving the bus anymore, but I got more involved with training elite athletes and also becoming more aware or involved with different national programs like volleyball and figure skating and fastball, like many sports. There wasn't much demand. I was a strength coach for those guys. And then I've got some offers from the NHL, never really wanting to go to the NHL because I was having a lot of fun at the time in Edmonton. That was in the glory days of the Oilers. But my wife suggested that if I get another, you know, serious offer, I should consider it because at that time I was traveling maybe about 170,000 miles a year, air miles. I was away from the family a lot. So I had got this offer from the Hurricanes or Hartford Whalers, and they said, hey, would you be our strength coach? And all I had to do was work a week a month. So you got to remember, I was in Edmonton. I flew down to Hartford for a week every month to be a consultant as a strength and conditioning coach. Then they moved to Raleigh and they asked me not just to be their strength coach, but also to be their head trainer. And so I got to be honest with you. One of the things I'm going to just tell you right now that I feel most proud about in my career was that for 21 years, I was not only the head trainer, I was also the strength coach, the physical therapist, and the massage therapist for the Carolina Hurricanes. So I carried a lot of targets on my back. And so I feel very fortunate that I could expand my understanding or knowledge of sports medicine, but I was able to hold those positions for that length of time. Hey, a long-winded answer, but that's how I got here to Raleigh, North Carolina.
And Pete, you wore those hats, but I don't think there is, I can say for sure there's nobody that ever wore those hats in the way you did and how well you did it. Like he did. And David's new to meeting you. And I know David, I actually heard Mike Boyle brought in Pete, maybe it was 99 or 2000, I think, to speak to his staff. It was one of the, you know, first staff educations, and it was amazing. Pete, I think we were talking about core strength and rehabilitation or whatever your topic was, but it was 30 of us, and it was great. You're such a great educator, and it just goes to show how much you continue to learn. Probably one of the still the best learners that I know of and have in my circle. And yeah, it's great.
Well, I'm very kind of you, Mike, to say that, because honestly, that's one of my attributes that I think I'm a lifelong learner, and so far, so good, sort of thing. I don't know how much more life's ahead of me, but I still get excited. Like, honestly, talking to you with blood profiling today, I've always wanted to associate myself with people like yourself, because I think you guys, my mentors, where I was coming, they're all dead now. So I look to you young guys in the profession and you know, carry the torch and hopefully, and like you have not disappointed me on this phone call. To be honest with you, you've got me excited. I can hardly wait to, you know, look into some of the things that you've sent me already. So I appreciate that. And life's good.
I want to dive into what Mike said about you being a lifelong learner. What tangibly does that look like? Does that look like certain habits you have to help you learn, certain practices, mindsets that help you keep learning and fulfill all those hats that you did?
Yeah. Hey, have you ever heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect? The Dunning-Kruger effect?
Yep.
Well, I got to be honest, I'm trying to avoid that. You know, I think that, you know, and there's another quote that I heard just recently is that in 10 years, we'll find out that 50% of everything we're doing now is wrong. Shit. And we don't know which 50% it is. And so what I find fascinating is, honestly, can I tell you a quick story? Why I'm a lifelong learner? I can't tell you these names, but this guy that my first meniscus tear that I ever saw in ice hockey was in 1980 with the Prince Albert Raiders. And it was that tear. Like, I couldn't tell you how, because we didn't have MRIs at the time, but what we did with him, and I gotta be honest, I'm looking forward to seeing him again sometime in my life before things get too bad, but we took the whole meniscus out. So you have a small cartilage tear in 1980, we ripped the whole damn thing out. Well, now we know. We do our best to, you know, rehab these things, to sew them up, to keep them in there. You know, we'll do anything. But point being is that that's what we did. My thing is that sports medicine is so exciting. It's changing. And if you don't keep ahead of it with the knowledge and the literature, you're going to fall behind real quickly. And so I was telling Mike, I think this is the first time in my life I think that I'm really up to date with all the literature on sports medicine, because we're doing a lot of things. And I have for the last maybe 5 or 6 years, I think strength and conditioning is on fire right now. They're the ones that are leading us to better develop athletes, not only for the prevention of injuries, but also in the enhancement of performance. We're not getting that same information out of the medical side of things. And I don't want to pick sides, but that's true. I listen to both. I read both literatures, and the strength and conditioning is what I think is. So the thing is, how can you not be excited to learn every day? Your access to information is so much easier. You know, I got to be honest, I bet you don't even know what microfiche is, do you? But that's how I used to have to look up damn articles. You have to go to the library right away to get a book. In about 2 weeks, it would come to you. Right now, I can turn on my computer and get access to anything. That's got to get a person fired up. You know what I mean? And then also developing network. Like, I'm trying to develop a network of people that I can phone up for blood profiling or ACLs or whatever I might be interested in. And I can get state-of-the-art technology education at a fingertips. That's got to get you fired up every day to get out of bed, for sure. Sorry, long-winded question, but that's how I stay.
You can do everything long-winded, Pete. This is not a short podcast. You can go as long as you want.
Hey, the other thing is, I think that I try to stay humble too, that I'm not the know-it-all, because, you know, again, a cliche, if you're the smartest guy in the room, you're in the wrong room. So I try to stay humble and try not to think that I know all I try to figure out all the answers, stand on the shoulders of great ones.
Pete, you're DPT and also an athletic trainer, and again, you've played the role for so many years. Who are your influencers or who are your teachers on the performance side, on the strength and conditioning side early on in your career?
Hey, I'm going to tell you something. The guy that I thought was the best, and I tried to replicate him, but have you ever heard of Lloyd Priestable?
Yeah, he wrote a hockey training text, didn't he?
He did. Yes. Yeah. Shit. If you read it, you're one of the few strength coaches in the NHL that read it. And God bless you if you did, because that shows me you know your roots. Because so many people say, well, they were the first strength coach. And what this guy was making, you know, noise in strength and conditioning and ice hockey in the late 50s and 60s sort of thing. He was also a national coach where, you know, he was with canoeing, skiing and things like that, but he was a really knowledgeable guy. And I honestly thought that he brought cross training, you know, to the forefront, not like we're doing now, but he really knew how to, I think, functional training and stuff like that. That's not something that just happened in the last 20 years. You know, Lloyd Priestable, I thought was at the forefront of that. He was, and actually I knew him when I've talked to him. He's passed now. Like I told you, my mentors are, all of them are dead. And unfortunately he's one of them, but you know, he was talking about nutrition and diet, even in the 60s and late 50s. He was one guy that I tried to read. I read that book, and there's people that have republished some of his writings, but he was one that stands out in my mind right away. There was another guy by the name of Howie Winger. Howie Winger was a strength coach. I got to meet him with the national program in the late 70s, early 80s. Now, I'm not going to tell you how many years ago that was, because you can do the math. And so if somebody listens to this, but he was an exercise physiologist from the University of Victoria. And I got to be honest, that guy, one, his knowledge of exercise physiology was beyond what I've ever met, sort of thing. But his passion and his excitement and how he delivered it to the athletes was beyond anybody else I'd ever met. He also worked as a consultant to the Kings, and I forgot the other teams, but he was another guy. But also to another one of my mentors, and this might be hard to believe, but I'm from Canada, and the series, the Canada-Russia series, the 72 series, kind of blew us all away, because we had these Russians come over and they just about kicked our asses at this series. They had Tretiak in net, and they focused on their players were bigger, stronger, and faster than any of the all-star Canadians we had on that team. But anyway, because our guys never did any cross training, they didn't do any summer training at that time. But there was a coach prior in the 50s and 60s. His name was Anatoly Tarasov. You remember that name?
Yeah.
But he actually showed the art of training an athlete. He had this guy, Tretiak, doing stupid dance moves in the net and doing split stuff. And, these are kind of my original guys that I thought, shit, I want to be like them. I want to bring my programming like those guys. So, yeah, those three people, I think, were the ones that really sort of steered my interest into strength training. And again, none of these guys were weight room guys. These were all, body control and artistic type fellas.
Yeah, movement, true movement, right? Yeah,
exactly.
Tarasov was the artist, and then I remember watching a documentary on that Red Army team, and then Tikhonov was more of the military guy. Tikhonov was the hard ass, and it was interesting. It was definitely interesting to see how that whole evolution. But yeah, I remember those names, like that Lloyd Percival. That name, it's like the godfather of kind of hockey training and education. And there's another, isometrics are now big, as and one of the best techs out there that's probably on microfiche is Doc Councilman, who was a swim coach out of the University of Indiana, I think. He really started that kind of isometric evolution. There's some unbelievable gems in this old book. Well, but that's neat.
Hey, yeah, you know what my new hobby is right now? My kids, ever since they were born, I'd buy them a book every Christmas, and I write something neat in it about what they had accomplished that year, sort of thing. And so that's a sort of a tradition in our family. But now what my kids buy me are old textbooks. And before they had ISBN numbers, I bet you didn't even know that there were books published before ISBN numbers, be honest with you. But
I think they were called scrolls.
The latest one they got me it was entitled Run, Run, Run by a guy named Fred Wilt. And he's an old track and field coach. Mike, have you heard of Fred Wilt?
No.
Oh, you probably will. The textbook, it sold originally for $3, but now it's well over $300 that the kids bought. But it's probably the single best text I've ever read on training different metabolic systems in running. But also, too, they had all the matrix that we're talking about now, like heart rate recovery and stuff like that, but even more basic and more detailed. But it just seems to me, too, even though I've told you a lot of things have changed, a lot of things have stayed the same, with following stuff. I think sometimes these metrics that we are following might be overwhelming, and really not necessary, to be honest with you. But that's my own view.
I'm more curious about these ancient Jedi hockey strength texts. I think it's kind of cool to say, oh yeah, I used to like read, Russian textbooks and translate them and all this stuff. But with 2021 eyes, are there one to three of those that you would recommend that a strength coach today should definitely still read and could still get a lot of value from?
Oh, I got to be on that Lloyd Priestable book. I still think that, but I don't know if it's available. You know, it's again, hey, hang on to your textbooks because, but maybe not, but they're becoming, they're rare and also too, they're expensive to buy sort of thing. But, you know, those are that one I would tell you is the best textbook is Lloyd Priestable. Mike, do you remember the title of it?
The Hockey Handbook.
Oh yeah, you're right. The Hockey Handbook. That's what, if you want to know your basic roots and stuff like that, that's the one where I would start.
Yeah. There's another one. Oh man, it was another really good one. I think it's called The Physics of Hockey. That's younger than The Hockey Handbook. And I haven't read the whole book, but I've paged through it, and it has a lot of cool considerations of like physics and angles and skating angles and things like that you should consider. I know the cover in my mind, but I think it's called The Physics of Hockey. It's one of the better books that I looked at early on in my time at spent it as an intern at BU and kind of get really exposed to hockey as the big major sport, you know. That's definitely one people should take a peek at too.
Yeah, all I can tell you too is that if you really want to, I think, understand or train hockey players, it's best to talk to good coaches. One, it's good networking to, you know, be around winning coaches and stuff like that. But they can tell you maneuvers and body movement patterns that are extremely important. Then if you can extrapolate that to the weight room or the track or wherever you might be training and get working on those movement patterns, I think that's really key, to be honest with you. You know, like, that's why because a lot of people think that, you know, ladder drills, have you ever heard, like some strength coaches nowadays are saying that's stupid. I don't, have you guys come across that?
I've heard that. Yeah. That stance now. Yeah. Yeah. I don't agree with it. I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't use the ladder drill for speed, but I tell you what, for coordination, warm up and kind of getting, you know, getting your mind and brain working with all the independent patterns that you're going through at different speeds and planes of movement, I think it's still a very good tool.
So yeah, there's no question. I think it's an essential thing. One, we know from ACLs and rehabilitation of that is that where you re-tear your ACLs usually change of direction. You can't tell me a better tool to change direction than a ladder, because every two steps you're changing directions. Maybe you might throw a jump in there. But more importantly, how many times, I'm sure you've heard a coach say head on a swivel. How many people can actually do a ladder with having their head looking upwards instead of at their feet, or actually looking over their right or their left? Now we're starting to use their vision, vestibular, motor system. Now that's starting to get me excited, because that's where I want my hockey player, so he doesn't get concussed, he doesn't get rocked going through the neutral zone. You know, he has a setup. You can practice that kind of stuff, that body movement patterns with a ladder. So I'm just, so you know, learning from coaches, I guess is what I'm saying, is that that's another resource that I don't think that we exploit enough in the area of strength and conditioning.
Yeah. You and I talked a lot about that reconditioning process prior to the call and what you're diving into and those who you're listening to and wanting to learn from. But you had the best of both worlds, being the ATC PT and then the strength coach, and being able to mold everything together. Like, can you share with us like that sort of injury process to back to the gym / okay, now they're ready to go from the gym to the ice? Like, where did you fit in and all these pieces along the way and bring coaches in and kind of direct that whole process or orchestrate that whole process?
Well, a lot of times when I always try to make sure the athlete always felt part of the team. So there's always communication, because as you know, a coach doesn't really want to see an injured player around. One, they don't have time. You know, they got to focus on their priorities and stuff like that. And that's winning games. And you know, if you don't do that, you're not in the NHL very long. So I think that, that I always tried to make sure that my athletes were informed with what was going on with the team and stuff like that. The other thing that the reason why I felt I had some success with this is that I never wanted to chase fitness. And so as soon as they got hurt, I tried to put something in their mind that would take them off the injury and keep them on themselves, because they were more than just that injury to me, sort of thing. So I never wanted to change. So, you know, there's an analogy that says, you know, if the one burner's hot on the stove, just go to the other burners that aren't hot, you know, and play with those things. So that's what I was trying to do. So if somebody had a knee injury or something, you know, I'd go to the contralateral side you know, or the torso or something. They're not, you know, they're not Michelangelo. They always had stuff to work on. So as quickly as I could, I would not want them to have to chase fitness. That means once they could move and stuff like that, well, they've just lost 2 weeks of conditioning. So that's one priority. And then they felt part of the team, right? And you know, like if it's a concussion, well, we got to be on their nutrition. They got to be taking their omega-3s. They got to be sharpening that up. They got to be working on good work to rest things. And you know, depending on the type of injury, I would be emphasizing, you know, for, as we know, or well, especially from concussion rehab, is that, you know, when you get concussed, you start to lose the ability to differentiate your body parts. And what I mean by that is all of a sudden, they might not find their, or somebody else's left hand as quickly as, or see somebody's left side as quickly as they used to, or their right side. They would lose that body awareness. And so one of the things that I try to keep them mentally active, or training their homunculus, both their motor and sensory, is one with that injured leg, say they have, it's a right ankle sprain, I would get them go through like a Sports Illustrated. And I'd say, listen, can you, with a Sharpie, draw a circle around everybody's right ankle. That's the ankle you hurt throughout the whole magazine. And if they're good, then I turn it sideways, do the same thing quicker, then upside down, and then 180, 360 degree. So they're going right around to see if they pick up their speed. And that's what I do initially, right? For the first couple, 3 or 4 days. But also with that, I'd get them to work on their contralateral side with mirror therapy and things like that, because we know that there's a carryover. So these are, you know, you might think they're meaningless tasks, but if you can tell the athlete why it's so important and actually what their expectations are when they get back to the ice, they say, oh shit, I better pay attention to this. And it's constantly changing, so they're not getting bored with their certain movements, sort of thing. So those are the things initially. And then as much as I can to incorporate them back into, you know, regular training. And I think that, yeah, that's what I try to do initially, to work on, you know, just, you know, body awareness, you know, the motor and sensory homunculus. And again, we know that, you know, when I went to school back in the 70s, they used to tell us that if you take two fingers together, at the end of 2 weeks, you would think you only had four fingers instead of five fingers. But we know actually now with neuroplasticity, you do that for 2 or 3 hours, the neuroplasticity or the neural budding actually changes within hours. So it's really important if you're telling an athlete that I want you to skate, you know, 30 miles an hour into a corner and stop on a razor's edge, and to take a blow of somebody else hitting you, you better instill confidence right from the get-go on that they can, you know, they won't have these lingering fears or kinesophobia when they're back into a game situation. You know what I mean? And that stands with all things. And that's why I think that the strength coaches need to play an intimate role right from the get-go throughout the whole process. And the better that, and that's why I did, you know what I mean? And that's why I think the more knowledge you have, the better it is for you. And I think it builds up a better team, medical team, when you work in that fashion. It's not one starts the other. And you know, if I'm a trainer, I have a guy that's returning from a hamstring strain, I better make sure that he's doing something productive every day to make sure that never comes back, whether it's just flossing or whatever. Yeah. Hey, does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, and you know, it's funny, like for our rock listeners, you know, Bon Jovi, the song is the same, but only the names change. Like you said it in an eloquent way, like Bill Knowles says, like every injury is a brain injury, and you have to kind of refresh that software program from injury site to brain, and how that interplay can be restored. Right. And cause it does change. It changes. Like you said,
It changes within hours. And I can actually show you a functional MRI that shows that sort of thing. And I just think that's the next step for strength coaches, honestly, is that I think we're pretty good at sets and reps and, you know, muscle hypertrophy and things like that. But I think working from the brain out, like he does, that's what's the trending. And again, I think a lot of this stuff has come from our soldiers that have been, you know, their legs have been knocked off them and stuff, like, you know, blown off or amputated, you know, a lot of that type of therapy. But we also are starting to appreciate that neuroplasticity. And when strength coaches start putting that into their, now we're going to have the head on a swivel, you know, we're going to use the eyes to their maximum. We're going to use the vestibular system and combining those two. You know how many, I honestly, and I'm not browbeating any profession, but I've seen a lot of rehab people, rehab ACLs, And it's always, well, one bad thing about being a physio or a trainer, they're usually working in a cubicle, right? That's maybe 4 feet or 5 feet by 10. I got not many athletes function in that region. You got to get them outside. You got, but also if you ask them to, you know, a football player or even a hockey player, and you want them to skate as fast as they can down the line, but take a puck from the opposite side, how often do they actually curve in that they don't have any disassociation? That's the type of, you know, and actually performance neurology, that's the new cutting trend, performance neurology, where they are looking at the brain out sort of thing. So anyways, that's what I'm, again, that's how you become a lifelong learner. You got to get fired up about shit like this, man.
You just keep making up questions.
Yeah. In some way, you might make an impact on the athlete's life.
Yeah.
Do you have any resource? Performance neurology is a new term for me, so I'm definitely learning here. Do you have any, you know, basic performance neurology for dummies resources that I could Google search afterwards?
You know, I'm sorry. That just escapes me. I wasn't expecting that question back. Thank you for listening to me, actually, though. But I can provide maybe your listeners and stuff like that. Unless you want a long pause in this podcast, let me get back to you on that, okay?
That's great. For everyone listening, will people give us those resources? They will be in the show notes on the website.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, that answers it. I don't want to leave anybody. Hey, but can I tell you something? If any of your listeners ever want to contact me directly, I'm more than happy. I've got a whole wide variety of, you know, resources. I'm more than happy to respond to anybody's email that I might be able to help.
You might get the hug of death. Yeah. Whichever way you wish for. But you said it.
You know, I gotta be honest, I don't think so. I think that only people that are keen and people that I want to be associated with ever follow up with something like that. So I think I'm okay.
Pete, in the coaching side, for all the years that you haven't just had to, you know, share, be the bearer of bad news with injured athletes from the medical standpoint, but also guys who are, you know, didn't come into camp in good enough shape. You know, you had to be the bearer of bad news to general managers and coaches in that light. So from a true coach's perspective, you know, how have you navigated those waters? You know, like, you don't have, give us some examples of tough conversations that you said, just had to tell them the truth and, you know, stand by what you said, and that's the deal. Yeah.
I gotta be honest. And I've had some coaches that, you know, they don't, and I'm not being disrespectful, but a lot of them don't understand work capacity and biomechanics and stuff like that. And a lot of the coaches would see a guy that's on a bike and he says, that guy's working his ass off. I said, well, coach, he really isn't. He's not that fit. But he looks like he is, you know. Same with skaters, you know, like some of the beautiful, the nicest skaters in the NHL, you think they're dogging it. They're not dogging it. They're just expending so much energy in each and every stride, the sort of thing. So you got to kind of educate them on that. And there's different ways of doing that, right? So you can look at a bike output, power output, and, you know, just, you know, I think it's really important that you understand the test, why you're testing it physiologically as it applies to hockey, because probably most people, and they nowadays, they don't at all. They don't give a shit what your MDO2 is. They, you know, and most of them don't care about anything with regards to that, unless you can tell them, hey, listen, I think this guy's outside speed is directly related to his long jump. This guy is strong on the puck because he has a standing vertical jump of, you know, 32 inches. This guy can, you know, so if you can start predicting shit like that, you got the coach's attention. But then the other thing is, so that's dealing with it. You got to, and I think the more you ask them questions, they'll start asking you the right questions back. So educating the coach is a key thing with players. Now, I've had some hard conversations with players who think that they, and especially older guys, because sometimes you, and Mikey, you tell me if you think this is wrong, but sometimes guys can stick around in the NHL and they're not in pristine shape. You know, their fat percentage is very high. And so then, and most of my coaches don't do skin calipers, but they do the eye test. You know, if that guy looks fat, he's probably fat, and it's going to be, you try and tell somebody that's been in the NHL as a tough guy for 10 years that he's got to drop 15 pounds or he's lighter than when he was in college. Those are hard conversations to have. Yeah. And so, but it's a little bit easier with the player because you know that the coach has got your back, hopefully. But if you don't have the trust of the coach, and I think we've all had coaches that don't back you, and that's not a, just like a trainer or strength coach. If you don't have a real solid team, you're not going to, you know, be successful. I don't care at any level, sort of thing. So you got to have that strong commitment or from all buddy, everybody involved, sort of thing. But you've got to just stress to them, apply to their, hey, you know, somebody told me once, you know how as a healthcare guy, you always have empathy for a player. Now, empathy, that's a good thing to have because it comes from your heart. And that, you know, like I kind of, but it's more important to have perspective because perspective comes from your brain. And what I mean by that is that, you know, it doesn't take a physics major that says that if you're a little bit lighter, the chances of you skating faster is better. The chance of you recovering from back-to-back games is better, sort of thing. So that's an easy, so you want to, think of the empathy, but look at their perspective and try and get them to see your perspective, you know, to accomplish your fitness goals.
Yeah, that's a great point. I would say like in my time with the players who've kind of are getting close to and aging out of the league, an aha moment, at least for me, we not really with body composition on my side, Pete, but it's been speed. Since the rules changes in, I think it was 04, 05, where, you know, you got to be able to skate. That D-man's got to skate with that forward. The forward can, you know, you can't just hook and grab and ride him into the boards. You know, so skating became more prevalent. I'm sure you've seen guys who played and weren't great skaters, made great careers, but when the rules changed, speed became more of the primary, there was a premium on it. So they kind of had, they aged out of it. So I always tell our older guys, like, I do not want you to get slower. You know, I do not want you to get slower because that's the quality you're going to get graded on, you know? And that's from a perspective standpoint, right?
Yeah. It's funny you say that. Two things I'd add to this conversation. I agree with you, is your speed's the first thing to go. The other thing, and so that's what, also the power on your shot. If you ask any old time NHL guy that's retired, they'll say those are the two things that go on you first, sort of thing. So it is imperative that you work on that stuff. And, you know, just from a young perspective, young guy, you know, they've got to work on those traits to maintain it, because once you've lost it, I don't know, Mike, if you've seen this, but I've seen guys that are, you know, in their 30s or mid 30s and they were really good one year. The next year, it's completely left them and they're dog shit. And it's funny how quickly that can take place. You know, I mean, some people, you know, they can maintain it for a longer period of time, but when it goes quickly.
I think this is the kind of, you've seen this, the guys who invest the most in their bodies and their physical preparation, they have amazing training habits. They can hang in there longer. That's, you know, but the guys who just naturally gifted had to be pulled into the gym and handheld or just held to the schedule, when it deteriorates for them, they try to chase it. And it you can't just flip the switch, in my opinion. You know, you can't just flip the switch and expect, all right, now I'm going to get down to 8% body fat. Now I'm going to work in the gym more so. But okay, that's a start, but I don't know if it's too late. You know,
I think it may be too late. I honestly think sometimes it is too late. And it's just like what I was telling you before with an injury. You can't chase fitness. You know what I mean? It's something that's built from one year to the next. And the other thing that, you know, the intangibles, like I don't think you just all of a sudden develop grit. You know, I had this one hockey player, and I'm going to drop a name because he's a close, dear friend of mine. And we've had many, you know, discussions on this topic, but his name is Ray Whitney. And Ray Whitney was a little fella, but he was fit as shit all the time. And I remember him coming through some devastating shoulder injuries, and we put him on a stair routine, and he just blew the doors off of everybody. And I asked, how the hell did you do that? Well, one, it wasn't because he was fit as heck, but he had grit. Like, he did not know. And I can tell you that didn't just happen overnight. That takes years of training over and over again. And so there's a lot of mental attributes too that happen with this training stuff, not just physiological stuff. And I think maybe the mental is more important too to maintaining your career, right? Because it's a hard, you know, like you just told me your year so far. Shit, I don't envy you at all, man. You know, but anyways, God bless you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. It's taking its toll. Trust me. I came into this job. This is my 15th year. I had a nice jet black hair, and now I have more salt and pepper than, you know, than Whole Foods, I guess.
So. Yeah. You're still a good looking man, though. I fake it. Yeah. Anyways,
to kind of diverge a little bit, how have you used or looked at the combine and assessing that group of young players? We haven't talked about this in our last guest, but in the past, you and I have talked a lot about the combine and what to add and what to clean up, more so than years past. So share with us a little bit about your perspective going into that event, what you're looking for, and then the communication lines that go to the scouts and general manager.
Yeah, that's a real weak point in the NHL, at least with my organization. I used to spend so much time putting reports together and digging in through their, you know, records, medical records and stuff. But I'm going to just tell you something. Still, the NHL is at a point where, you know, the scouts and they do watch that player in and out sort of thing, day in and day out sort of thing. So I don't know how much of my reporting help, but I do remember, actually, I started doing combines, NHL combines, when we didn't have the combine, where we had regional sites throughout Canada. And so I was at the University of Saskatchewan and I test some players with MVO2 and aerobic lactic acid type stuff. And then also at the U of A, then we start to combine them all together in Toronto. And so I've been involved in this at a very early age. But again, what I remember the first time going there, they wouldn't take pictures of the guys. And so my guys back there, it was hard for me to, I'd only see them once, right? That they were interested. So I started taking pictures from the sidelines and, you know, front, side and back. And the next year I go in there and the NHL people took my camera away. It says, you can't do that anymore. And so, but eventually they started taking pictures and they were much better with it. Pod grid behind it and stuff like that. And so that's good because, you know, you could see if the guy had scoliosis, the limb length and stuff like that. I still believe to this day we can up that. And I don't know because I haven't been involved in the last 3 years, but, you know, I really believe that we could start really honing that down to better train them and to also better predict their outcomes. I think that the NFL's gone overboard. Sort of thing where they actually have people strength training or stretching out the person's hand in order to increase their width from their little finger to their thumb because they think that might enhance their ability to grab a ball. And that's a measurement that they do. So their metrics are way overboard, but I think that we need a but I think it's getting better. When they moved it to Buffalo, they seem to have increased it and stuff like that. But you can also see a tremendous difference between you know, U.S. college kids, their training, competing at the combines versus some guy that was in the WHL. You know, they just have a totally different ability to vertical jump. Like it's almost somebody's learned how to jump, the other guy doesn't, sort of thing. It's not on their physical attributes. It's just bad coaching, sort of thing. So that's a problem. So at the combines, it would be neat to be able to differentiate those two people, you know, the ones that are well-trained and the ones that aren't. And then, be able to predict.
From all your learning and continued learning and then seeing that, being involved with that event so long, what are some of your first choices to add in, if anything?
Well,
because we did, for our listeners, just so you know, like we went through a period of having so many tests and probably took the athlete an hour and 40 minutes to get through all the tests, and he would finish. Like Pete said, he would start off with photographs in front of this grid board and wingspan, and so you could see kind of structure. They would finish with a wind gate, 5 minute break, and then the VO2. So very taxing and a lot of tests. But now we're to the point where we're pretty streamlined and very streamlined and spread things out. Go ahead. I wanted to set the little precedent there.
Yeah. Well, that's a tough one. To be honest with you. I guess I would like to see some basic, and I don't know what type of anthropometric measurements they do now, but I do think that that's really relevant even now or any time sort of thing, because I've always been, but you don't have to do like what the NFL does, like the wingspan of your hand. That might be good. That's, but, you know, looking at the sport and how to generate force and things like that, I think the limb to torso ratio is really important. I think that as long as they can correlate that or look at if there's any correlation with that with previous injuries, that's an important thing. And also to the basic movement patterns, I think. But again, you know, we're looking there as at potential, not at what they have right now. So I think with a mindset with that, that's what we should be looking at. Because again, if you see guys that have deltoids, you know, 6 inches past their acromion, well, they've been in the weight room a lot, right? I'm just kidding you. There won't be 6 inches. But the point being is that other people have never been on a bench press. So I think that bench press is a stupid idea, to be honest with you, because I just know for, actually, our good friend Mike Boyle, but maybe not. I don't want to be a name dropper, but bench pressing is for, you know, honestly, to develop your pecs. And that's what we need in order to swing on a tree. But the point is that for hockey, you don't really need big pecs. Actually, if you look at people like Gordie Howe, Bobby Orr, those guys don't have any pecs at all. So where are your pecs, Gordie? But they have, you know, other muscles that actually facilitate, you know, the shot, you know, on being tough on the puck. We should look at more of those things than, oh, NFL does bench press, we better do bench press. That's and then also too, I just know that's terrible on your shoulders. Our sport's terrible on your shoulders. And if you're going to test it, you know damn well those kids are going to train for it, sort of thing. So I'd rather them not. We know grip strength is huge, right? Well, let's kind of correlate that. Let's do a good job of grip strength. Anyways, that's, I'm wandering on, but those are a couple of my insights that I would change or look at.
What are some grip strength ones you'd include? Just, I'm curious about the specifics here.
Oh, hey, you know, can I tell you, it's really interesting because grip strength, you can, you know, be sitting, test your grip strength. But to be honest with you, what I'd rather do is, you know, from the side, pulling it all the way down, standing. And so that if there's a discrepancy, a lot of times it's because of your body posture and things like that. So, you know, looking at grip strength like that. Also, too, you know, at the combines, now, Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, the width of the grip strength monitors, you know, it's really dependent on your creases of your hands. Right. And I don't know if they ever changed the size of the grip dynamometer.
I don't think they do.
I don't think so either. But the point being is that where I got that little tidbit was from occupational therapists who see hands all the time. It's really important that they measure correctly treatment after treatment. These guys don't look at that so closely. Now, if we think grip strength is important, let's do it. Now, they say that, you know, a farmer's carry, if you're carrying like 2 45-pound plates in your hand and you're walking across the street or something like that, you think the weakest link, right, is in your hand. Your grip muscles, your lumbrical muscles give up. But in actual fact, what gives out first and foremost is usually your head posture slips forward or your shoulders go forward, which makes you in a weakened position. So the thing is, going back to your question, I'd like to make sure that I test those guys, you know, in a correct anatomical position with their shoulders back and down, their head, you know, over their shoulders, test it like that. And then also in their natural resting position, because those are two different measures, right? And so I just know if you're a volleyball player or if you have any type of neurological involvement from your neck and stuff like that, usually you might get a sore wrist, but it could be actually coming from your head or neck or shoulder sort of thing. So that's the kind of nuances I'd like to see with grip testing. But again, going back to Mike's question, I can't keep them there for 2.5 days of testing. You know, I got to make them very productive sort of thing. But I think there's a way of doing that, you know, like combined movements, you know what I mean? Like a step up to a press. We got to do that with our testing, you know, throwing in maybe 2 or 3 movements that we're getting good information out of.
I think also, like you alluded to, there's not only what your score is, but also how you interpret those scores. So to use your example of, let's say a major junior player and an NCAA player have the same vertical jump, but the NCAA player clearly is better technically jumping. How you then communicate that as the strength coach, like, hey, this major junior player is actually probably more explosive. He just needed to teach him how to jump a bit more. So as the strength coach, how do you then like take that info and communicate to your scouting team and the coaching staff, et cetera?
Hey, Mike, who is that number one draft pick? He plays for Buffalo now. He's from Boston U.
Jack Eichel.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Jack Eichel do a long jump or a vertical jump?
I did, yeah.
Man, I don't want to say the F word, but that guy was unbelievable. His biomechanics, his hip extension, his ability to blow out at the apex of his jump with spit coming out of his mouth. Like, I could have watched that all day long, to be honest with you. I don't know. Did you coach him?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't there for Jack. I believe he was a young 14-year-old, 15-year-old working on in Mike's gym in the summer times, to be honest with you. And then he committed to BU with Jack Parker very early, maybe 15. So he definitely is well trained, and you could see it in his skating. He's such a powerful skater, right?
Like, absolutely. So yeah, but the only thing is,
get him off the puck.
Yeah, you show a kid that doesn't know how to jump, or somebody that has equivalent, saying you're not doing this, you can get to this, and it's going to blow this guy by 2 inches. Then you got their mindset, sort of thing. So I always like to use, you know, demonstrations, and I still honestly, I could go on my computer, maybe not quickly, but show you pictures of him at the combines. He was phenomenal. And that's the way I want to train my guys that are from, you know, Northern Saskatchewan sort of thing, to be like that or wherever, you know what I mean? Where they don't have access to, and maybe he didn't have coaching. Maybe he was just gifted, but that guy had unbelievable biomechanics.
A little caveat to that combine that he was at. I remember that was one of the first years, if not the first, we went to the force plates for vertical jump testing and all the metrics that go along with utilizing force plates. And he was way above everybody else. You could tell. And it was to the point where it was like, okay, when we reanalyze the data at the end of the combine, it's like, oh, something went wrong with his test. And it's like, no, nothing went wrong. Cause you can look back at the video and he just was textbook, you know, vertical jump, non-counter movement jump and all that stuff. So.
Yeah. It was a guy that really stood out in my mind.
Yeah. Because you and I sit, Pete and I usually sit in the same spot at the combine. So the combine is laid out left to right, right across the hockey rink. Yeah. And you got to get there early. You got to get there and save your seat in front of the test that you want to see. And Pete and I were always pretty much, Pete, correct me if I'm wrong, we were right by the vertical jump and long jump stations, you know? And if you wanted to go see Wingate and see somebody with some grit during the Wingate, just run down the line and put your bag on your seat so nobody took it, you know, but you know, it was posturing for sure. You had to claim your territory.
You know, I got to be honest. I almost feel, and I'm maybe aging, my almost grandfather myself, because when it was in Toronto, that one seat was always for me, the first one. And so it was where I could get a good look at. Now people thought maybe I was a pervert, but you know, they'd come in their gym shorts and stuff like that. Be honest with you, this is where it goes, is that they used to come in with little t-shirts on and stuff like that. I said, hey, listen, do you mind if you could take your shirt off so I can, you know, and I'm not like that. But the point being is I want to see if there were any scars, right? You know, like if there was a scoliosis, if there was, you know, some atrophy, and you could really pick that up closely. And I honestly thought at the Wingate, and I know my good friend Reg Grant, I think, was always at the Wingate or MVO too, but I always thought you could get that information on a piece of paper. Sort of thing, when the guy quits, you know what I mean? But it's interesting. But the biomechanics guys, like the different strength coaches, always circulated to the different tests that they liked. So I do remember that. Yeah, good time.
You know, you've made it when you got your seat saved for you. So yeah. That's it. Yes.
And they take your camera away.
Pete, you've talked about how I like your quote, and I'm probably misquoting, but it's basically 50% of what we say we know is wrong, we just don't know which 50%. I'm wondering if what things you think we're wrong about right now that we could improve as strength coaches, kind of like your example of the agility ladders.
Yeah, I honestly think that we're paying too much attention to physiology and stuff like that. I honestly believe that because of brain research and concussion, we're not thinking the importance of the brain. Well, we're forgetting about that. We're focusing more on physical function. So I think we're losing that right now. And, you know, like your eyes drive the body. I think the basic stuff, I think the green leafy vegetables, the basics, that's what we're missing right now. We're going too high tech, honestly. You know, and you might correct me if I'm wrong, because I've been out of the league for 3 years, but we're bringing in people from all over the world to analyze their athletes from Australia and England and stuff like that. Do they know what a head on a swivel is for a D-man? You know, what's a second set of eyes for a defenseman? Well, that's what your partner is, you know what I mean? If not, you're going to get killed, sort of thing. I think that, you know, the basic stuff, we're forgetting about all that stuff, and we're going to too high tech stuff. I think in 10 years from now, we're going to say, this stats is bullshit, and that we need to keep this, you know, we need metrics. There's no question about it. But I think we're following too many things, and it's just making us not as good as we could be. That's what I think. Does that answer your question?
Paralysis by analysis sometimes, Pete. Yeah,
I believe that. I honestly believe that. And it's happening in all sports, not just ice hockey.
Can we get clear on what we mean by the basics on the ice, off the ice? Just when we say the basics, those leafy green vegetables, what do we mean by that?
Well, movement patterns. You know, going back to, you know, like I was talking about, you know, Lloyd Priestable or people like that, they were always saying that, you know, playing soccer is a good thing. That's a basic skill. You know what I mean? That you use your eyes and your hand or your feet, and that carries over to ice hockey. A lot of playing tennis is an eye-hand coordination type thing with the puck. Most of the, I think all the great Czech players, and I didn't realize such a big sport in Czech, but they're all great tennis players, soccer players. Those are the basic things that I think that we're getting away from. You know, like even simple ladder drills, that's skipping, right? Those are the, and we're getting into complex, you know, different Kaiser maneuver patterns where we can load certain joints, different types of apparatuses that we can isolate muscles instead of looking at just overall function, using the brain as the driver. That's the kind of stuff I'm talking about.
No, I think that last point is important. It's an important point because, I mean, I'm at a point for me that you have so much technology out there, and one, sometimes you may feel left behind, like, oh, geez, I'm not using force plates, or I'm not doing a 1080, or I don't have a catapult. I'm, you know, and you're like, okay, am I missing the boat on a lot of these things? And you know, for me, the pieces of technology that we bring in is to truly obviously analyze what are the best characteristics of these players. You know, I can tell you right now, Patrick Marleau is super strong, can produce a lot of force, and he's the best skater I've ever worked with in my time here. And I think we've had a lot of really good ones. So kind of to know what goes into a guy like Patrick Marleau and makes him really great and strong at what he does and try to reproduce those qualities, I think that's what you got to dig out of it. But at the same time, if we're looking at way too much stuff, you know, then you can lose your way, because then your program becomes sporadic and it doesn't have the same foundation it did or it could that you when you first started, maybe. You know, I think you got to be careful of that as a coach.
Yeah, I know a couple of NHL teams that could get whatever they wanted to with technology. And I know one time the first year that catapult sort of became famous, they bought the catapult system and they spent $80,000 to $100,000 on that, not to just trash it the year after, sort of thing, because it just gave too much data. They didn't see any relevance to it. But, you know, and maybe this will come to this, but what I've researched in that is if you're looking at those types of metrics, you're going to have to keep it for at least 4 years on this one player to be able to, you know, use it to make that player better. Like maybe this is going, and I have 10 years of university. I taught and I still teach at four universities around here. So I'm very involved in research. But the point being is that the NHL ain't ever, and I use that ain't, going to be a university research site. You just can't do it. That's why pro teams don't provide a lot of research, because it just doesn't get done. So you're expecting these metrics that are, you know, university grid stuff, it's not going to apply to the NHL, I don't believe, unless you're going to have a very regimented team that doesn't have ebbs and flows, because you know how coaches will go off on that, or GMs, and you're going to have to collect that data. You're going to have to analyze it. You're going to have to be able to control these other variables, you know, like what time they get to sleep. You know, I know this is a sort of a hearsay story, but the Vancouver Canucks, they were studying sleep and they gave every one of their athletes a sleep watch in order to measure how much they sleep. They go, oh, we need more sleep. So instead of flying home for Dallas, it would stay overnight. Well, guess what happened to the boys in Dallas that night when they didn't fly home? They were up even later partaking in a few beverages, adult beverages. It actually made the thing worse. Point is, we can't control these people like rats, like they do at universities and research projects. So I got to be honest, that's why I'm saying you got to stick to the green leafy vegetables. Sometimes it might not make sense, but it does. So I really think that the amount of emphasis we're putting on technology right now, we're going to see that's going to be in our rear view mirrors, and we'll just pick up the few basic things, just like COVID, right? We're going to pick up some really great things. We don't know what they are from COVID, but going on, you know, like Mike was saying, smaller group training. That's a great thing, I think, for the NHL to go to, sort of thing. You know, so we're going to learn some things from what we're going through right now, and maybe we'll reconvene in 10 years and I'll tell you what 50% was bullshit.
I love
it. Well said,
Pete. That is the perfect full circle way to wrap up. This has been so much fun. You're such a wealth of energy. I definitely want to know your secret to, is it caffeine or whatever it is? I want it. But just final thoughts, ask of the audience, places where people can reach out and say hello.
Oh, well, one, my email is Pete F, pretty simple, Pete F 0808 at gmail.com. And so that's, again, if anybody's interested, I'm more than happy to share any type of information, because honestly, I've been in 1980s when I first started saving NHL programs. So I can tell you, you know, what works from, from 1980, what was the Montreal Canadiens, but a lot of guys didn't have programs, but that's when I started. On Twitter, it's at PeteF08. So if anybody, and I try to pass on all the gems that I pick up onto my Twitter account. So if people want to follow up like that, like I said, it's so easy to get access to information nowadays. And so those are the two places, or Twitter and also my email, that are happy to return anybody's questions or if they can help me out. You know what I mean? That's when learning really occurs. You know, when I talk to Mike, if I can help him out a little bit, I know he's going to help me out 10 times more. So that's a relationship. Then I know learning has occurred. So anyways, if there's anybody in your viewership that want to, you know, get in touch and start a study group, I'm your man.
I might take you up on that. Pete, Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time. This has been so much fun. Have a great evening, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Pete.
Yeah, thanks for your time, guys.
Take care.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you got something out of it, learned something from Pete. Obviously, really smart guy, and definitely I want whatever he does, whatever his morning routine is, I want it. As always, links to everything discussed you can find in the show notes at prohockeystrength.com. I even found those old books that both Pete and Mike were talking about, so those are also included. And I also really recommend that Red Army documentary that features Tarasov. Is actually a really good documentary. Anyway, that's all I got for you guys today. So thank you so much for listening. And for anything else, you can find us at prohockeystrength.com.